Welcome to We've Got Issues. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, we will speak with media critic Dan Frumkin about the how the legacy press is no friend of liberals or the left. And then we'll be joined by Jared Facundo from The American Prospect to talk about the right using its relatively new propaganda against, quote, wokeness as a cover for its very old campaign to undermine public education. But first, I have a pet peeve that I would like to share with you fine people this week. I feel that I have read a million articles that quote former federal prosecutors claiming that the walls appear to be closing in around Donald Trump. A million articles. Every week there are articles, new articles. Oh, this suggests that the walls are closing in around Donald Trump. Donald Trump, he's running scared, right? During his presidency, the story was that Mueller was closing in on Trump. Since then, it's the DOJ or Fannie Willis, the prosecutor down in Atlanta, prosecutors in New York. For a while, there was talk of a potential prosecution in California. You're familiar with this. Now, regular listeners know that I am actually hopeful that Trump will be held accountable at some point. I know a lot of people, including people we've had on this show, who are confident that Trump and other high-level Republicans will never face any consequences of any kind for the insurgency of dunces. But I'm not one of those people, right? I feel like we are in uncharted territory. And I believe that we should offer a bit of humility in making predictions about how this will shake out. You may have experience of other presidents trying to overturn the results of the election, as the media likes to say, but I'm not aware of that. I don't recall other incidents like that. And also there are absolutely indications that prosecutors are focusing on Trump and are kind of acting aggressively. Special counsel Jack Smith subpoenaed Mike Pence this week and Mark Meadows, who served as Trump's chief of staff. His team in the DOJ is also in court trying to get a judge to rule that some of Trump's lawyers have to testify despite claiming attorney-client privilege because of what's known as the crime fraud exception, which means you can't hide behind attorney-client privilege to cover up a crime. And by the way, the lawyer doesn't have to be in on the crime themselves. It just means a client can't rely on that to hide evidence. So it feels like there is stuff going on. There was a partial report from the Fulton County grand jury was released this week, found that the grand jury thought that there was that some of the officials who testified perjured themselves, et cetera, et cetera. But just from the perspective of the media, these endless stories are all following the same model, right? They aren't news. The typical formula is like this. Prosecutors or Trump's lawyers will file some pleading publicly. Reporters pick up on that, whatever it is, that motion. They go to a former federal prosecutor who now teaches at law school or maybe writes for a blog like Lawfare. A federal prosecutor who probably is a contributor to CNN or MSNBC or whatever. And they say, well, this could be a sign of blah, blah, blah. And back when I was prosecuting La Cosa Nostra or corrupt politicians or whatever, we filed similar motions. So this is what it suggests to me. Then reporters will go to an anonymous source close to Trump or a source who is familiar with Team Trump's thinking. By the way, that's just some schmuck, some Washington schmuck, some right winger who's trying to get some influence. So they'll go to a source close to Trump or someone who's familiar with Team Trump's thinking, and they'll say that something like people close to Trump are getting really nervous about this thing that may be happening, right? where Trump's lawyers are getting nervous about this thing that may be happening. And then you slap a headline on it, like, and I'll just look at a few from this week. So why Jack Smith going after crime fraud on Trump attorney privilege matters, which is from MSNBC. Or one more sign that special counsel Jack Smith is dead serious from the Bulwark, right? And there's dozens of these stories. Every week, dozens of these stories. I'm so tired of them. You know, Trump has been committing crimes very openly. Like, that's his secret sauce. You brag about the crime, and then you say, if it was a crime, I wouldn't be bragging about it, right? I wouldn't tell you on TV. I wouldn't go to Lester Holt on NBC and say, I fired, you know, James Comey to obstruct justice. That can't be a crime. I said it on NBC. So he's been committing crimes very openly for 7 years now. It's been 2 years since he tried to orchestrate a ham-fisted coup attempt. And it's all newsworthy, of course. These are legit news stories. A filing was made here. A filing was made there. Somebody's saying that the walls are, you know, experts are weighing in. But even if they're legit news stories, they just have very little substance. And I'm sick of feeling manipulated by them. Like, I don't want to always get my hopes up. And obviously I don't. But still, like, you're like, oh, God, the walls are closing in. Just get this shit started already. You know, if they ever file charges against Trump or John Eastman or the Republican officials who tried to submit fake electors or any other high-ranking figures, that would only really be the first step in what would without doubt be a long, drawn-out legal battle. And until something happens, I just don't want to read any more about what legal experts glean from reading between the lines of court filings. It's clickbait, and it's tiring. Anyway, I'm glad to get that off my chest. Thank you for hearing me out. I don't have a therapist. I need to do this to somebody. Stay tuned, and we'll be right back with Dan Frumkin.
I wasn't starting yet. I didn't even think you were listening. I wasn't ready at all to say anything about anything interesting. It's the thing you have, you just don't know that you do it. You wait around in a conversation while I get in and start stumbling through it. I was so distracted then, I didn't have it straight in my head. I didn't have my face on yet, or the role or the feel of where I was going with it all. I was suffering more than I let on. The tropic morning news was on. There's nothing stopping me now from saying all the painful parts I'd lie. Got to my feet, feeling that I'd let you down.
And we're back. I'm still Joshua Holland, and I'm joined now by Dan Frumkin. Dan is a veteran journalist and media critic. He writes and edits Press Watch, which you can and should check out at presswatchers.org, not .com. Dan, welcome back to We've Got Issues.
Thanks, Josh. Always good to talk to you.
Always a pleasure to have you on the show. This week, almost 200 contributors to the New York Times and hundreds of other journalists wrote an open letter to Philip Corbett. He is the associate managing editor for Standards at the Times. And they decried the paper's relentless efforts to fuel a moral panic over transgender people. The letter is long. Listeners can go check it out. You just Google letter to the New York Times transgender. It details a lot of shitty reporting on transgender youth and related issues, some of which failed to disclose sources involved in right-wing advocacy groups. So they just said, oh, this is a concerned parent, but actually it's somebody from some, you know, Christian right organization. A lot of these stories ended up being cited by right-wing lawmakers pushing a wave of punitive anti-trans legislation in red states. And we've talked about this before. There's more laws banning transgender girls from participating in sports than there are transgender girls trying to participate in scholastic sports. Dan, this seems consistent with a lot of ostensibly neutral media outlets reporting on an array of issues being pushed by the right. What do you make of all of this?
Well, that was an extraordinary letter. And what it demonstrated to me was that a lot of the people who work at the Times and these other organizations don't subscribe to some of these right-wing framings and narratives that the paper ends up producing in the news section. So, what I mean, it's important to point out that we're talking about news articles mostly here. And, you know, this is from an organization that prides itself in not taking sides. And yes. The reality is it takes sides all the time. And it does that mostly by adopting Republican talking points and narratives to determine what their tone is, but more importantly, what their subject is. So there, you know, ergo 15,000 words in the New York Times about transgender surgery, and all this coverage of trans people in sports. These are constructed as part of the culture war, and places like the Times just jump all over them because of the editors and the corporate culture. I think I don't blame the individual reporters so much for a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's actually a hard question. I think some of the reporters do deserve some blame and are, you know, kind of ensconced in that same group thing.
Sure.
Same
at the end of the day, thing. It's their name on the story, and yeah. They absolutely deserve blame. But I'm just saying, and if you're trying to fix it,
yeah,
I think you fix it at the corporate culture level.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. You have a piece up at presswatchers.org. It's titled, "Press Criticism is Everywhere, but the Industry Isn't Listening." Which, of course, as you acknowledge in the piece, isn't quite right, because they are exquisitely sensitive to criticism from the right. Generations of bad faith criticism centered on the idea that the legacy media are hopelessly biased towards the left. Now, you offer some examples of big media outlets, and here I will quote you, letting right-wing narratives determine their tone and their agenda, story after story after story. So we talked about the trans panic stuff. It's extremely dangerous. What are some of the other areas where you see right-wingers setting the tone of mainstream coverage?
Well, let me specify one thing, which is that I don't know that the editors are exquisitely sensitive to right-wing critiques. I think they've internalized it, which is even worse.
Yeah, so, that's right.
So they would say, "Oh, well, we get, you know, we don't care about this criticism," but they've internalized this concern that they will come off as liberal, and they're worse, you know, they imagine worse things than even than the criticism they actually get, probably. But as far to answer your question, though, I mean, there's a number of glaring things that have come up lately that just show how incredibly loyal the New York Times, the Washington Post, these other organizations are to this Republican narrative. So one example is the New York Times' egregious coverage of Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. And they keep on depicting him as like an underdog fighting the establishment. They actually had a headline, you know, that said, DeSantis takes on the education establishment and builds his brand. This is a guy who is banning books, using his political power against his enemies, stoking division, spreading conspiracy theories, you know, censoring teachers. This is not some hero, underdog hero fighting the establishment. Another one was this constant reporting on the debt ceiling and the debt crisis, the debt ceiling debate, as if it's some sort of a crisis and a standoff, when in fact it's a completely a hostage-taking situation. It's completely an extortion, you know, Republican extortion.
Yeah.
And every day there's more articles now saying, "Oh, well, gee, the debt is a big issue, and Biden's going to have to address it." And there was recently a story in the New York Times talking about how, "Oh, you know, Social Security is a big issue." Biden just basically cleared the decks, say the union address, and took that off the table. But they're still rooting for it. So again, another example of the press having an agenda, which is somehow they feel like you're not serious unless you're punishing poor people and the elderly.
That's yeah. Group of that's true. You also bring up the tendency to act as if there are similarities between Joe Biden's handling of some classified documents after his vice presidency and Trump's very willful and relentless obstruction of efforts to regain control of documents that he took. And you do mention the ridiculous attention given to that Chinese balloon, which was something that was really just stoked by Fox News, as far as I'm concerned, and Republican lawmakers. I never understood why anybody would be freaked out by that balloon. It was not that big of a deal. And I just want to also, before we move on, the piece about DeSantis was so egregious. Right. It just reminded me that if you replace the vague term culture wars with the more precise word fascism, a lot of fuzzy reporting comes into focus, right? And that was such a good example. The lead on that piece, by the way, and I quote, "Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida, as he positions himself for a run for president next year, has become an increasingly vocal culture warrior, vowing to take on liberal orthodoxy and its champions, whether they are at Disney, on Martha's Vineyard, or in the state's public libraries." It's
astonishing.
As Dan noted, this was not in the opinion section. It was a news analysis and had bylines by three different Times reporters. Dan, you've written a lot about the Times for obvious reasons. There appears to be a rightward shift underway across other big media institutions. The CNN under Chris Licht has supposedly moving towards the center, they say. But he's banished a number of people who the right view as insane in their criticism of Donald Trump, etc. And then the Washington Post laid off dozens of reporters and at the same time hired a number of right-wing opinion havers from the National Review. Some people who see these problems say it's just a result of corporate owners imposing their conservative views on these outlets. I don't know that explanation is complete. I think that is a problem that mostly impacts coverage of parent companies' businesses. What do you think is driving this apparent move to the right among the legacy? Okay.
At the end of the day, ownership has an enormous amount to do with it. It can, you know, the owner is letting this happen or is making it happen. Either one. I mean, they're it's not happening against their will. Interestingly enough, the New York Times and the Washington Post have very different owner dynamics that are acting out in the same way. Bezos is not involved, in day-to-day at the Post, but the extraordinary range of his economic interests is creates such a conflict of interest. And he has been outwardly skeptical of Biden and of Biden's economic policies. And I don't think it's a surprise that you're seeing coverage that is very skeptical of Biden and his economic policies in the Washington Post, more so than the New York Times even. At the Times, I don't get it. I think Sulzberger, the publisher, I think it's sort of a social pressure. He wants to appear to be, the reasonable man. And so he has ended up encouraging his entire newsroom and editorial section to find fault with the left as often as possible and to accept Republican narratives when they're even vaguely palatable to them. So at the end of the day, yes, it's owners. Part of it sometimes, and the editors that they pick. I mean, keep in mind that Bezos now has his own handpicked editors running the newsroom and the opinion section. Sulzberger picks who the editors are. The only thing in their defense is that sometimes I think mid-level editors go further than even the boss wants because they're trying to please the boss, but that's not much of an excuse.
So I want to talk a little bit about what something that we had mentioned in passing, which is this desperate desire to not be perceived as having liberal bias. As you said, they've internalized those criticisms from the right, which have, again, been levied at the press for generations now. Mm-hmm. You wrote, and I quote, "Since writing and speaking the truth would, according to many reporters, make them look partisan. They adopt Republican narratives instead. I think this is such an important point. We should take a moment to unpack it. Vox had a piece last year by Zach Bocamp, which I thought was very important. It was titled, "The Republican Party is an Authoritarian Outlier." And Bocamp wrote, and I will quote again, "Experts on comparative politics say the GOP is an extremist outlier, no longer belonging in the same conversation with normal right-wing parties like Canada's Conservative Party or Germany's Christian Democratic Party. Instead, it more closely resembles more extreme right parties like Viktor Orban's Fidesz in Hungary or Erdogan's AKP in Turkey that have actively worked to dismantle democracy in their own countries." And I want to point out that Bocamp, this isn't an opinion piece, he cited a survey of 2,000 experts on political parties from around the world. And the consensus among this group was that the GOP's closest peers are, and again, I quote, "almost uniformly radical right and anti-democratic parties." So this is a long-winded way to ask this question, but sometimes I do that. To what degree do you think reporters feel that if they just accurately describe what is going on with the American right in the Donald Trump era, or I should say since the election of Barack Obama, just doing that would make them seem like they are partisans opposed to Republicans? So just doing their jobs of accurately informing people at this point makes them look that way.
Right. Well, I mean, let's look back at history a little bit. I mean, 20, 30, 40 years ago, this sort of split the difference, both sides have a point approach. At least both sides were based in reality. At least there were some sincere people with integrity in the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. So it didn't fail miserably, but sometime along the way, and I would argue it was well before Trump, the Republican Party became an extremist party. Norm Ornstein and Tom Mann wrote a great article back in 2012, was it? About how the Republican Party had gone off the rails, and the press just hadn't noticed. So that's what's going on, is they don't realize that the game has changed and they're continuing to play the old game. And you know, when you're triangulating between two positions and you're just sort of trying to be in the middle and one position has gone way off to the fringe, you've been driven into the fringe. And at some point, these people need to say, look, this isn't working anymore. I mean, good Lord, how many political reporters, you know, theoretically take the job because they want to create an informed electorate. How many people could say that this is working right now? You know, not a lot. So they needed to say, what's going on? Let's stick to some core principles. And if instead of sticking to triangulation, they stuck to core principles like, let's examine what the problems are in our country and our world and what some possible solutions are and who's advancing possible solutions and who's kneecapping possible solutions, that would have been a great, an honest way to report on things. But instead, they cover, it's like they're the trade publication for political campaigns. And they're just sort of, you know, whatever the campaign does is normal because that's what they're doing. It's a really tragic situation. That Vox piece, I think, hit it right on the head.
Yeah, it did. The New York Times has a new opinion columnist, Pamela Paul. She's not new to the Times, by the way. She used to be the editor of the Review of Books, but she is a new opinion columnist. She is, I think, just the worst, laziest kind of purveyor of boring, like anti-woke clickbait pieces. Although she fancies herself being this very nuanced, subtle thinker. And I say they're boring, those pieces are boring, because you see the same piece over and over and over again. You know, college kids are too sensitive. Me Too went too far. People are mean on the internet. And, you know, and that's a threat to free speech. I don't know how people keep churning these formulaic pieces out. Like, as a writer, I never want to just fart out the same piece that's been done a million times at a million outlets. But anyway, I digress. Paul has defended her positioning. Go ahead, Dan.
No, I think that Paul's hiring is an clear indication of what it is that Sulzberger is asking for, because she is absolutely the anti-woke fighter. And she's an idiot. I mean, her columns are absolutely ridiculous.
They're so stupid.
They are fake and ludicrous. I mean, you know, right now they're sort of fun for a hate read, but they're going to lose that allure pretty soon. Even
I can't even hate read them, honestly.
There was a wonderful New Yorker piece about her that sort of just roasted her. And I'm proud to say, quoted.
You were quoted in that.
But in general, people are starting to realize that she is just a noxious presence on that page. And yeah, she was just added. Why would that be? Well, that tells you everything.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it does. That piece is called The Rules According to Pamela Paul, by the way. And it is a really good piece. I suggest everybody reads it. It's by Molly Fisher. And it's in the current, a couple weeks ago it came out in the New Yorker. So the question that I have about Paul is that she's defended her positioning as an ostensibly liberal contrarian, right? That's how she
sees herself. That's how she would describe herself. Yeah.
And she's defended her positioning by saying that if she's being criticized by both sides, and I don't actually know that she's gotten a lot of criticism from the right, but she says if she's taking fire from both sides, then she must be like over the target. And this is a very common refrain from reporters. She's not a reporter, but from media figures who are being criticized.
Oh, it's their favorite.
It is their favorite. And I wonder what your take on it is.
Well, it's a great way of avoiding actual accountability for what you wrote. You're saying, well, both sides hated it, so it must be okay. You're not defending it, not explaining why you wrote it.
And what if both sides hate it, maybe you're full of shit.
Both sides hate it, you know what? It could be really bad.
It could be terrible. I mean, both sides agree on so little, but they both agree that you suck. Maybe don't be so proud of that.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, her latest column was what? Headlined, What Liberals Can Learn from Ron DeSantis. Okay.
I couldn't
tell,
even
tell me, tell me, tell me she got criticized from both sides for that one.
Dan, before I let you go, I think that the media's multiple and often cross-cutting biases really are enabling anti-democratic forces to kind of run under the radar, right? So you talk about culture wars again, that obscures a lot of very serious fascism and authoritarianism going on. And the idea that both sides are threats to free speech obscures the reality that one side is actually using the government to control speech. The other side is complaining to moderators at Twitter or whatever. What would be your prescription for the problems we've been talking about today? Or is there one?
I mean, it's just facing reality. I mean, I just on Twitter linked to a really great piece by a guy named Jacob Glick, who was one of the investigators in the January 6th committee. And what he says is what the committee found, they didn't stress this in the report because, you know, Liz Cheney wanted to be all about Trump. But a really strong, violent, you know, authoritarian movement out there that Trump sort of briefly tapped into, but it's there. It's racist, it's anti-government, it's anti-democratic. And if you sat down a journalist and any of these political reporters and you said, okay, let's assume for a moment this is true, should we not be writing about this all the time? I think they would say, yeah, come to think of it. And then you ask them, well, is it true? And I think the answer would have to be, yeah. So that's my intervention right there. Just read this piece. Tell me if it's true. Tell me why you're not writing about it all the time.
Yeah. I think we need to work the refs. I think we need to work the refs like they do. I think that's really...
I actually don't think that will work because, as I said, it's been internalized now. But no, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't continue criticizing them. And we shouldn't continue... Yeah. You know, tough love for a news establishment that at least, you know, compared to the other guys, is based in reality.
Yeah. And that's a really good point. I mean, calling it tough love is an important distinction between criticism from the left and the right. You know, we want the media to do a better job and they want the media to not do their jobs. And that's a very, very big difference, I think.
Yes.
Dan Frumkin, I believe we're about out of time, but I really want to thank you for taking the time to speak with me today.
My pleasure.
Folks, we're going to take a quick break and then come right back to talk more about the right to war in public education in the guise of anti-wokeness. Stay tuned.
Put your loving hand out, baby, 'cause I'm begging. Yeah! I'm begging, begging you to put your loving. I played hard and fast, like I was there. I walked away. You want me there? But easy come and easy go. Well, I didn't answer. So, eight to my see, you let me know. Y'all, yeah, eight to my bleed, you let me go. Eight to my see, you let me know. But the plan I just see you, just let me go. Because I'm on my knees when I'm begging. Because I don't want to lose you. Hey, yeah. Because I'm begging, begging you. So,
and we are back. I think our segments this week kind of dovetail nicely. We're going to look now at how the right is using the cover of their culture wars, as people like to refer to them, to target public education, which they are only able to get away with to the degree that they have gotten away with it because of credulous reporting in the legacy media. Anyway, we're joined now by Jared Facundo. He is a writing fellow for the American Prospect. He has a piece this week at TAP, which listeners can check out at prospect.org. It's titled, Will the Education Culture War Backfire on Republicans? Jared, welcome to We've Got Issues.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Thanks for taking the time today. You know, I feel like we've kind of had a similar path to some degree. I see that you were an intern at IPS, the Institute for Policy Studies, and I used to work out of their office when I was in DC.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And then you were also a Nation intern, and perhaps when I was a regular contributor. When were you a Nation intern?
I was a Nation intern in late 2021.
Okay, that was after my time. And now you're with the Prospect, which I've written for in the past. Anyway, I guess it's a small world. The war on wokeness, which is a word that no right winger ever defines. Why is that? Why do you think they don't want to define it?
I don't think they want to define it just because it's when it comes to wokeness, I think there are like genuine concerns that parents might have about whatever's going on, but the way that these battles like play out, it's usually a mirage for a school choice, school voucher agenda.
And well, the wokeness thing, though, they apply that to every walk of life, right? So woke military.
Yeah, it's just a woke scapegoat. You know what I mean? You can project the worst fantasy somebody might have about whatever they find disgusting onto wokeness. Like there is no like truly concrete thing about it.
Yeah.
And that's what makes it so useful as like as political rhetoric.
Yes, that's right. Anyway, you've written about how it's become a rallying cry for the authoritarian right when it comes to education in the context of schools. They've tried to couch their opposition to teaching accurate history and whatnot as a matter of parental choice. Parents, they say, should have the right to opt little Johnny out of, learning anything that might make him uncomfortable or seeing others who don't conform to traditional gender norms or whatever. But you write that, and I quote here, the new culture war over the future of education is a stalking horse for the same old battle over school choice. The not too hidden goal of denigrating public schools is to weaken support for teachers and their unions and to redirect funds into school vouchers and other programs that pummel public education even further. Jared, would you unpack that for us? What is the mechanism that connects anti-wokeness to the right's kind of a longstanding assault on public education and teachers unions, etc.
Yeah. So this attack on wokeness, it's really an attack on teachers and their teacher unions, which, as you quoted, it's about going after public schools. Like, really what it comes down to, if you can hear, you can like literally look at Chris Rufo's like Twitter feed, and he'll talk about that. Oh, this is the building the momentum or propelling a school choice grassroots movement. Like, the whole idea is that your children are being taught XYZ things about wokeness or whatever, just whatever sort of pearl clutching that's happening with conservatives.
Critical race
and theory. Critical race theory, exactly. Or transgender athletes and alike. And the whole idea behind this is that parents are going to demand taking their children out of schools, and that usually translates to either homeschooling, which is weird about this like right wing coalition against teachers and unions, is that they're not all private school types. Some of them are private schools, some of them want to do homeschooling, but the point being is that there is a lot of money on the table. It is it's like some $170 billion in federal money that came through different coronavirus aid packages that's like there for schools. And now you have this weird conglomeration of these groups who are trying to get their share of the pie. And that's really what this conservative backlash to wokeness in schools is a front for.
See, that's really interesting. So, and I don't think that I've heard this elsewhere. You have an enormous amount of COVID support for schools that has not been dispersed yet. Is that right?
Yeah. I think in the piece that I say, it's about like $14.2 billion that we know of that has been dispersed, but there are lags in how the data is reported, just because it takes a while to compile all of this. There's like, you have state level education boards, and then from there it gets divvied down to school districts. And also some of this money, like especially when it comes to hiring, the total cost of it won't be known because you're having to pay someone's salary over a sustained period of time. Right. But either way being, there are more than $100 billion worth of federal money that's for schools that's on the table.
And so they're trying to get a piece of that into parents' pockets through the vouchers, or into private schools or charter schools?
That's where it kind of gets dicey, because if you talk to people who work in like the education policy space, is that there really isn't a total alignment with these school reform or education reform types on who wants it. They can all agree enough that they want to get this money, but they don't all agree who on where it should go. That's where it's kind of it's a departure from how the education reform movement played out in like the 2000s, when Democrats were really proponents of charter schools. Like back then, everybody was kind of like in lockstep that charter schools are like the way to go. And now it's kind of Betsy DeVos really polarized how education reform was seen. You know, she kind of just became like emblematic of like the worst excesses of school choice. So that's where it's kind of, it's no longer really a bipartisan issue on charter school. That's why it's more, this has a lot more energy in the Republican Party.
I'm going to get back to that, but I mean, I think that we should, you know, make it clear that this coronavirus funding is fairly recent, but the ideological project to undermine public education dates back far longer. It is a really long-term project. And a lot of this is sneaky. In the first segment, we talked about the New York Times running this fawning profile of Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and his assaults on public education. Are you familiar with his so-called Teacher's Bill of Rights?
I am not.
So what it would do is it would just decimate Florida's public teachers unions, right? Which are one of the few bulwarks against his increasingly authoritarian brand of government, right? He's becoming a little Orban down there in Florida. And it's extremely targeted to basically a, if it were to pass in its current form, given other measures, other anti-union measures that he had previously passed, it would make it pretty much impossible to have a teachers union down in Florida. And I think that I shouldn't say that it's going to pass in this final form, but he, the thing that's so sneaky about it is that he would decimate teachers unions, but he does it under the guise of protecting teachers from unions. And he has combined this by sweetening the pot, by giving Florida teachers, if this measure passes, a pay raise of $200 billion over so many years. I don't know exactly the number, but these teachers are, Florida teachers are the third lowest paid in the country on average. And that is a way that he's trying to kind of blunt the opposition to this very draconian measure. Now, of course, he is in also in an open war with the College Board, which pushed back on some of his, well, let's call it what it is, racist propaganda about African-American studies programs. College Board operates advanced placement exams, and DeSantis is threatening to abolish them. Nobody really knows what the consequence of a state just saying, oh, we're not going to have AP tests anymore. Like, what happens to Florida high schoolers who want to get into good colleges and don't have any ability to take an advanced placement course? It's really crazy stuff down there. So, Jared, school choice on its face sounds like a good thing. It's a, I think it's a smart slogan. It seems like it would appeal, you know, to people who don't pay a lot of attention to education policy. They'd say, oh, well, great. Let's have more choice. More choice is a good thing. What's the actual problem with giving people vouchers to use to educate their kids outside of the public school system?
I think the most illustrative example is typically when we're talking about vouchers, it is sometimes they're called like educational savings plans. They have like great sounding titles. They make it sound like, oh, this brings choice to you.
Yes.
When it comes to your child's education. So let's take, for example, a $10,000 educational savings plan that a parent gets if they take their child out of their local public school. The idea being that, oh, you can use this taxpayer dollars that would have gone towards the school. It's now up to you and how you get to decide this. So you could like put this into homeschooling or put it towards a private school. But the problem, though, is that just because you take one kid out of school, it doesn't mean that, let's say, the utility bills for the public school are going to like cut down by 1,000. And that's just like a very, I don't even want to say, like a silly example, but it's like a minor example. Now, take this on the scale of extracurriculars, school nurses, special education, after school programs, sports programs, and school budgets. They don't operate like the federal budget. Like they kind of have some sort of grounding to, I guess, so-called kitchen table economics or whatever you want to call it, where when a budget's strapped, they have to make cuts. And typically those cuts are going to be along like these additional programs that we're talking about. And in the end, like that just translates to students who suffer the most. And like all the stuff you were saying about like DeSantis, like it's very egregious, but I think the most important thing to remember in all of it is that like none of it is really care. Like none of what they say is about for the well-being of students. Like it never is. Like you can look at DeSantis, you can look at the 1776 Project PAC, Moms for Liberty, all these other groups who are trying to be so-called education reformers.
Right. I mean, I think this is a point that people seem to get on some instinctive level. You cite public opinion data showing that parents, by and large, are not buying these arguments to the degree that you would think that they might, given how good it sounds. And by the way, as an aside, conservatives are so good at these slogans, at packaging things, school choice, education choice. That's great, right? Like, sounds great. And then we're like, abolish the police. Like, what the hell, dude? Why are we so bad at this? I think we should have, I've said this on the show many times, I think we should have taken defund the police, which is a great policy. Let's take some police funding and reallocate it to non-police first responders. Super idea. We should have just called it safer communities or something like that. That's what they would have done.
Anyway, innocuous, yes. I mean,
given how far into this stuff politicians like DeSantis and others are leaning, you would think it's been proven to be politically salient and helped Republicans win elections. But I mean, that doesn't seem to be the case, right?
Yeah, that's not quite exactly the case. And it goes back to all this money that we're talking about, like this $100+ billion that's like sitting there for schools. Like, I can't give you a timeline on how long it's going to take for that money to like run out, but at one point it's going to, and that's when, like the title of the piece, will this education culture war backfire? That's kind of like where we'll start talking about like this, or we could potentially see this backfire on Republicans, that when these schools are moved, like are forced to go on like a strapped budget, like what do they start cutting? What does this crying about critical race theory or books that are too salacious for teenagers, does this still hold when your school has to cut its like free lunch program, right, or you lose your ESL program, or right, you lose a school nurse?
Yeah, you know, we're operating in a pretty hostile media environment. I wouldn't say that the efforts by like Democrats and teachers unions and public education advocates to tell the public, hey, wokeness is a giant distraction from the real project, is going great. But it seems like when it comes to educating kids, people tend to have a kind of they're more connected to the reality of what's going on than maybe they are in other areas of public policy. I want to circle back. You made an interesting point, and you made this point in your piece about the shifting views of so-called school choice measures between the two major parties. You point out that Barack Obama was a big advocate of vouchers. He wasn't alone in the Democratic Party. And Democrats of color, by the way, have long been pretty positive about these measures. And you write that as a result, and I quote, the most devastating effects of education reform took place in Democratic-run cities. I take it that one effect of Glenn Youngkin and Ron DeSantis and all of these other right-wingers leaning into this anti-wokeness as a cover for attacks on public education is shifting the views of those on the other side of the aisle. How do you see the landscape of this kind of libertarian, quote, education reform changing?
Yeah, I think it's really important you brought up how this stuff has changed between the parties, because I think first off is that the coalition for charter schools isn't a totally partisan one. And I guess like what happened with Democrats is that where Obama championed the need for education reform, as it was called then, which really was just like a privatization of the school system, was by weakening teachers and their teachers' unions by forcing states to lift caps on charter schools. And there's, I don't know, people, you can cherry pick the evidence you want to say that, oh, charter schools lead me to this conclusion that, oh, they are students who go to them perform better. But at the end of the day, I think it comes down to a question of like first values, first principles, whatever you want to call it, is do we believe in public education, like as an institution? Right. And that's probably the most like devastating thing that happened. Like where Democrats who nominally or ostensibly speaking should be champions of public institutions in cities where they run the place completely, they completely capsized public education. Like I list off like Detroit, Philadelphia, Newark, Chicago. And Chicago in particular, it was like an insane amount of like elementary schools that closed. And just because they all closed, that doesn't mean that every single kid gets back into a comparable school system. And I know that there are valid arguments over the quality of these schools, but like just because equality, you're not reaching whatever threshold is there, you don't give up on them.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think people are starting to open their eyes to what this is all about. And it's funny because we were just talking, my friend and I were just talking about how terrible Rahm Emanuel was the other day. He was like a real champion for this. Jared Facundo, I believe we are about out of time. I really want to thank you for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thanks so much.
I'd also like to thank Dan Frumkin and David Edwards, our producer and engineer. You can follow me on Mastodon at Joshua Holland. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. Of course, I would like to thank all of you fine and discerning people for tuning in. Have a terrific week.